Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk. Breathe. Rechalk. Still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Welcome to another hour of live true crime coverage every morning, 11 a.m. Central on YouTube. If you're missing it, if you don't get your true crime cup of coffee in the morning anymore over on Court TV, I'm just saying,
daughter.
We're here for you every day at 11 a.m. Central. So please do come join us. We got a lot to get through today talking about the Corey Richens trial. The defense is in the Corey Richens trial trying something bold, putting the victim's past on trial. They're suggesting Eric Richens had a history with drugs and that the fentanyl that killed him may have come from somewhere other than Corey, despite all the evidence that shows that it came from a chain of Corey's housekeeper to the drug dealer. Anyway, that's something else, according to them. His best friend and business partner sat on the witness stand and said he'd never seen Eric touch anything. Joining us to discuss, as always, my co-host, Robin Drake, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, former FBI. And Eric Faddis is with us, former prosecutor and defense attorney. Eric, let's dive in here. The defense wanted to put Eric's alleged high school drug use in front of the jury. Let's put it in perspective here. High school would have been the late 90s for Eric. That's how far back we're talking here. The judge said, nah, we're not going to go back to the late 90s when the original screams were out and whatever you were doing around a bonfire is evidence that gets into this case. That evidence is out. Eric, when a judge cuts off a piece that your defense theory is trying to bring before the jury before they're even able to get it there, no matter how ridiculous it may be, what does that do to their argument and the fact that they're having to reach that far back as well?
You know, best laid plans often don't materialize, and that's what happens in trial. You know, you've got to roll with the punches. You've got a game plan going in, and then there are rulings that come up. There are witness issues that come up. Sometimes there's new evidence that comes up, and so you've got to improvise. You've got to adapt to that. But certainly, it's a huge blow to defense because it's kind of central to their theory, as far-fetched as some might believe it to be.
Yeah, and Eric, I was looking at this question when we're, you know, putting everything together ahead of time, and not just that, but so I did this research also, and it didn't take much just because it's all been laid out there about Corey. You would think behaviorally that if there was an issue Eric had with drugs, either he started it back in high school, he'd have to continue this in order for being an addiction, and they're proclaiming it a secret addiction. But nowhere did any family member, any friend, Corey herself ever make mention to family, friends, or anything else that there's been a change in Eric's behavior. There's been an escalation. There's been some issues. There's been no suspicions. That's another element of this. How does defense kind of leap over the fact that it's never been claimed before?
You know, I think that's terribly problematic because especially folks who have been around those with addiction issues, especially if you're close to them, it becomes rather prominent and it becomes noticeable and it becomes a problem usually in their lives. And so the fact that no one's ever brought this up, you know, we're just bringing up on the eve of trial, during trial, when Corey Richens is on trial for murder, certainly raises some eyebrows. You know, on the other hand, I suppose if it was a secret addiction and you know, perhaps Corey didn't want to talk about it, perhaps his siblings or his family members didn't want to talk about it, perhaps that's the reason that it hasn't been reported. I think that's the way defense might style it, but certainly suspect.
Do you think this was a planned route they were taking before the trial started of this, or is it something they kind of did impromptu along the way as they saw things go? In other words, was it more of a desperation move, you think, on their part, or was it premeditated they were going to bring it up no matter what?
You know, as a defense attorney, you're talking with your client and you're kind of like, hey, what is an alternative explanation for this? If you didn't do this, what could have happened? And my apprehension is that Corey kind of told her attorneys, hey, maybe he had some personal substance issues going on and he did this to himself. And then as the attorney, you have to try to corroborate that. So you're looking for evidence. And sometimes you got to look far back. If that evidence is so attenuated, what is its weight? What does that really matter? And how compelling would that be to the jury that, you know, I don't know, some guy was, like Tony said, doing shrooms around a bonfire 30 years ago or something. Does that mean that he killed himself with fentanyl in this case? That's a bit of a stretch.
And I'm sorry, Tony, one more follow-up on that. Having to go that far back in the cases that you've been around, is that typical or is that a really super big stretch they had to make on that, do you think?
Oh, it's a super big stretch, and I'm not surprised by the judge's ruling. You know, their judges are not inclined to let the defense engage in character assassination of the alleged victim by bringing up, you know, every potential misstep and wrong this person might have done throughout the decades of their life.
It's like a statute of limitation on stupid.
That's one way to put it. Yeah, we can
modify them. I got another one today. I'm done. I mean,
that's a great one. The statute of limitation on stupid. I like that. I like that. It should be a T-shirt. I like it a lot.
It goes with finding calm in the chaos.
Yeah, very much. Very much. I mean, essentially, it's a play on the jury. It's a play on people. It's a play on humanity. And basically hoping that someone out there may have some sort of similar situation in their life that they can relate to and go, oh, yeah, I didn't know about that forever, too, with so-and-so. It can happen. And that's essentially what they're trying to do by just saying, well, maybe it came from somewhere else. Maybe it did. But having some evidence to back that up certainly helps. And when you don't have much, I mean, wouldn't if Eric had some sort of drug issue for all these years leading up, wouldn't that have been like the first damn thing out of Corey's mouth the night he died? I mean, wouldn't that be the thing that they'd be looking at right away? Wouldn't this be like the story that she's screaming from the heavens? My God, you know, be aware of what your partner's into, you know, because for me, it was too late. I don't know. I mean, to try and play this card that she was just clueless as to this being a thing whatsoever. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of good things point. That partners can do behind the other's back, and they are clueless to it. But I don't know. This one just seems to be a bit much.
You know, that's what we'd expect, Tony, is that the spouse of a decedent who died, you know, in an inexplicable fashion, appears to be possibly a chemical source of that death. You'd think their partner would be like, gosh, you know what? Like, he was struggling with this stuff and it was escalating and becoming a problem. On the other hand, you know, perhaps she didn't know about it or didn't know a lot about it. Perhaps when this death occurred and she's talking with police, you know, it's chaotic. And then, you know, she doesn't want to disparage her dead husband. And so, you know, maybe those could be speculative reasons why she wouldn't mention it. So it can be played both ways, but the jury's got to decide what's the most reasonable interpretation of how she addressed that issue with police.
Do you think, Eric, that if defense goes down this road when they take over the case, you know, today or whenever, that it shifts to them, that prosecution might, you know, attack it with even things like the call to the medical examiner? Because these are such really good points we're making that if there was no arc of suspicion, not even confirmation, because I know people can hide amazing things when you have secret place. I've done lots of investigations where family members are completely unaware. But you always have behavior leakage where you're in denial, you don't want to acknowledge it because there's a pattern and escalation of a change over time. And I would think, though, if there was that, like we were saying, if there's that some sort of suspicion going on, people in the family, friends would say, it makes sense now, you know, the hindsight being 20/20. And I would think that even that call to the medical examiner might have looked a little bit different. You think they might go down that road on it?
Yeah, certainly they might. And, you know, one thing the prosecutor might bring out in defense's case in chief, if they're sort of riding this horse that, hey, Eric had this drug issue, he overdosed, that's what happened. Well, prosecutor can show an absence of evidence supporting that. They can show, hey, you know, we've got his cell phone. We don't see his cell phone records. We don't see, you know, a bunch of text messages with known dealers speaking in code about, you know, different types of drugs. We don't see, you know, rehab stints. We don't see hospitalizations. We don't see the things you might expect someone who is really struggling with a drug addiction so much so that they overdose themselves. So I think the prosecutor has some traction in terms of how they're going to challenge.
And buying from ranches connected to Mexico and things like that, right?
Well, and who does have the track record of secret coded messages on cell phones about to drug dealers, you know, about the Michael Jackson stuff? Corey happens to have that in her background. I mean, and these are things that you can't even argue your way out of. You can't be like, well, that's just malarkey. It's real. It's there. It happened. They can go down this chain of, well, she asked for the Michael Jackson stuff. He thought it was oxycodone. One of them thought it was Oxycontin. The other thought it was, who knows? I mean, nobody seemed to know the damn name of the actual drug. But at the end of the day, the intent is what happened. That's what they procured. She wanted strong stuff, the Michael Jackson stuff. I don't see any other meaning behind when someone says, I'd like the Michael Jackson stuff, other than I want something that's going to kill my husband. I mean, can you interpret that any other way? And I've asked this. I've asked this too, so as a defense attorney, so I'm curious to get your take on it. Does it matter that none of them seem to know exactly what was in those pills, other than it was something very strong that could kill somebody? The fact that they all kind of had different names for everything, does that make a difference that Corey didn't say, I want fentanyl? She got something that killed her husband. It's what she asked for. Does that whole chain of wording, the verbiage, does it matter?
You know, these nuanced issues come up a lot. How do we give meaning to a person's statements at a trial? The prosecution is going to zoom out. They're going to say, hey, look, she wanted some super strong drugs, and then her husband died of super strong drugs. You don't have to be a genius to connect the dots on that. Defense is going to get more granular. They're going to say, hey, prosecution has to prove how this person died, has to prove Corey Richens is connected to that. And if the substances about which Corey Richens was speaking are different than the substances that killed Eric Richens, then is that doubt? Does that inject some confusion, some uncertainty as to what happened, by whom it was procured, and how it was administered? So it's kind of, you know, prosecution zooming out, defense going to zoom in, and then the jury's probably going to land somewhere in the middle.
Is the defense of Corey, is Corey inadvertently displaying a pattern of deception in real time to the jury in this trial? Because it seems like they just keep adding in stuff that really doesn't paint a great picture for Corey while they're trying to really railroad the dead guy, the victim here, Eric Richens, into this corner of he's having a torrid affair with his best friend, and which is just malarkey. Then is he getting drugs from somewhere else off the street? We can't say who or where or when. We have no evidence to point to that, but whoa, he did some stuff in high school. He was abusive. We can't prove any of that. There's no track record of any of this or anyone ever saying this other than when it works to the advantage of Corey Richens to make her look like a victim herself. Everything that is coming out doesn't have any sort of legs to it, and it all points in one direction to make Corey Richens look like a victim when she truly is a victimizer, clearly, in this case, or alleged to be the victimizer. This is not a great look. I mean, is the jury seeing the pattern of Corey's deception just continuing to be exercised in real time as they keep throwing more things into the mix that really don't need to be there? I mean, are they just digging their hole deeper?
you know, I sense a hint of desperation on behalf of the Richens camp, and that's not unexpected. She's on trial for murder, facing significant evidence against her. And, you know, on the legal, you know, you can have sort of a legalistic approach to a trial and say, hey, theoretically, you can't rule out X and Y. So you can't say that she for sure did this. But the jury, they're not professional jurors. They're just normal people. And so they're not going to be evaluating it from such a legalistic perspective. They're going to be evaluating it from, what do I believe? And when you're sort of throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks, sometimes the jury picks up on that and they say, whoa, wait a second. If they're selling me some BS on this side, what else are they trying to sell?
You know, Eric, it looks like defense is clearly, at least from our, you know, grandstand optics, is losing the battle of character assassination of Corey versus Eric. What do you think, you know, if that was their original plan, was trying to do that, and it's obviously just keeps falling flat that they're having to go back to high school to try to assassinate his character, what do you think they might try to do to adjust to this when they actually, you know, when they try to make their defense and make their points?
You know, you really have to try to bring it all home in closing argument. You have to, even though you don't have a burden on the defense side, the judge wants to be able to place faith in whatever arguments you're making and whatever evidence you're presenting. And so you have to kind of connect the dots, bring it all together, show how it leads to reasonable doubt. But Robin, if you've already lost some credibility with the jury, and this thing's gone on for some time, these jurors are making credibility determinations of the witnesses, but also of each side and of the attorneys. If you've lost that credibility, it's going to be a hard road come closing argument to be, you know, saying things with a straight face, and the jury's looking at you all sideways saying no.
Is there any last play? You know, so say, you know, defense attorneys, they got reps, you have reps, and every time you get a rep, you know, facing a situation like this, you get better at it and better at it. And then you kind of have your playbook on if X, Y happens, do this, if this happens, do this. And I'm sure it's not the first time these attorneys have faced, you know, credibility issues with their client and it's going sideways like this. Is there a typical thing that they'll roll out the last minute as like the Hail Mary, do you think, on this, that'll kind of hopefully give it that shot so they can help it boost their closing argument? Or, and I know we're ways off from the closing argument, but, you know, what do they typically want to do on an adjustment like this?
You know, you want to kind of end your case with a bang. You want something memorable on both sides, including defense side. And then in closing arguments, some things I've seen in similar circumstances are, defense is going to be real with you for a minute. You know, my client is not a saint. My client, you might not like my client. I've seen attorneys go up there and be like, hey, I don't even like my client. But that doesn't mean that they're guilty of murder. They may have made some questionable choices, might not have been the choices you've made. But the central issue is not whether you like Corey Richens. The central issue is whether the prosecution has proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And here are the holes. Here are the weaknesses. Here is what constitutes that doubt. Find them not guilty. That's a common road in closing argument under similar circumstances.
So many questions in this case. We'll see where all of this lands in the coming weeks. Your thoughts in the comment section on our Substack and our YouTube. We'd love to continue our conversation there. The prosecution's case rests on a three-person drug chain in the trial of Corey Richens, a supplier, a middleman, and Corey. The problem is that the supplier and the middleman both have immunity deals. One of them changed his story. The other changed hers when serious prison time entered the picture. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor here with us to help break all this down. Eric, let's make sure everyone understands what an immunity deal actually means, because I think some people assume it means someone is telling the truth because they have nothing left to gain. Or it might be interpreted as they're spinning a story to protect themselves. Because if they don't tell a story this way, well, there's going to be some negative repercussions for not doing that. That's how the defense is trying to position it. And it's really kind of a somewhat true statement. It's not like that's not true. How do juries typically interpret this sort of a situation where you got folks who are telling a specific version of the story? Because, yeah, they got immunity. Had they not agreed to testify, they'd be in jail. There's clear incentive to tell a version of a story there, true or not.
I think it's a really important question because I think prosecutors and even defense attorneys see it a lot differently than like a normal juror. I think a normal juror is going to look at that and on, you know, not all of them, but on the balance, kind of have some cognitive dissonance, kind of saying, hey, wait a sec. Like, you're saying Corey Richens did these crimes, but this other person is admitting to doing crimes and you're not doing anything to them. They don't have any penalty or they have a lesser penalty. What's that about? That seems a bit like cheating. That seems a bit like manipulation. That seems a bit like tailoring a witness testimony to benefit one side in exchange for a tremendous benefit to that witness. So that witness has an interest in what they're doing and how they're presenting information and the testimony they're giving. So when I was a prosecutor, I tried to avoid immunity at all costs because I think the jury looks at it kind of with a side eye saying, it seems a little bit shady that this person committed a crime, but you're going to let them off. But you're telling us, hey, you know, throw Gordon to the wolves.
Yeah, it's interesting. I looked up double immunities for cases is actually kind of common. It's not uncommon, but it does affect the credibility. It's like 20-30% of jurors definitely look at credibility of immunity issues as being a problematic for them. And so when you're the prosecutor, are you going to battle, do you think, to bolster that credibility, or are you just going to kind of sideswipe it and go at another angle, do you think?
Well, it's tough, you know, Robin, in this case with the housekeeper, my understanding is there were some, alleged crimes in her background that came out. Right. And so, you know, and as a prosecutor, one thing we would say in closing often is like, hey, we didn't get to pick these witnesses. These aren't like hand selected, you know, upstanding nuns or something. These are the people who are involved in the case. And so I think you have to be real with the jury. I think you have to be like, hey, look, there is this immunity deal on the table, but look at what she's saying and look at how it's corroborated by objective evidence that is not manipulated, that is not subject to immunity.
So do you think Tony, it's a really interesting point you made that I was picking up on that. So it really is not just the credibility of the witness, but a lot of times the skill set of the prosecutor and their ability to really talk very well to the jury. From what you're seeing so far in the case, how are the prosecutors doing with that, do you think?
They're doing reasonably well, you know, but there have been some questionable things in the backgrounds of some witnesses who are key witnesses in this case, including inconsistent statements, prior alleged crimes, and all of that is going to be evaluated by this jury.
Yeah. I mean, there's number one, I want to say this because I think you brought up something interesting, Eric, that I think is the tip of the trial, the tip that if they're listening to us, if they're going, oh, hey, there's an idea we should bring up, like the hair follicle thing. Here you go. Here's another you're welcome, Corey Richens defense. She should go dressed as a nun. Every day going forward, she should have the full getup on every day she goes in there. You know, what is that called? What's it called when the habit? Yes, the habit. I think if Corey went in as a nun every day going forward, case closed. She's free.
You think?
I don't know if anyone's ever tried that. You know, everybody, you know, they, because she's looking very
literally matrixly. The Hail Mary, right?
Literally the Hail Mary. She should do a Hail Mary. She comes in dressed as Mary, and she's with child, and she hasn't had sex with anybody. And that, oh my God. Oh my gosh. You
or
get one
claim-
religious. Were religious not in that jury? You got it.
Or that she had an epiphany and owning her behavior, being vulnerable and transparent is really interesting.
She found God, and this is there you go. You're welcome,
so,
Corey.
Yeah. So Eric, actually, it's a good question, Eric, on that. So Eric, do you ever happen to hit a point with your client that you have to do something drastic, like say, this ain't working, man. You got to shift up how you're presenting in the courtroom.
Oh, certainly. I mean, the jury is going to be laser focused on the defendant, on how they're reacting to testimony, mm-hmm. their facial expressions, their posture, all of that. And so you got to have a serious talk with the client beforehand about that. And sometimes you can control for that stuff. Sometimes you can't. And you have to kind of play the hand you're dealt. And if you can't, you kind of say, you know, hey, this person is being railroaded. If you've noticed them throughout the trial, they're clearly jarred by this. They're physically affected. That's what you've been noticing. That's a deer in the headlights of an unfair prosecution. That's one way defense could address that.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tony.
How do you think she's doing so far in the courtroom? I mean, she's looking very, very matronly, very, you know, just subdued. It's incongruent with the stories that we hear about her. We hear about this very monstrous, very I'm stealing money this way. I'm taking out loans over here. There's a lot of like horrible behavior going on. And when you look at her, you're like, She doesn't seem like, if you were to profile her and think, well, what does this monster look like? It doesn't look like, you don't think Corey Richens is that person. Do you think that's working well, or can that work against a defendant sometimes where it's just so far off base from these stories over here that it really shows, oh God, they're still trying really hard over here to bamboozle everyone. She's trying so hard over here simply because she's looking the way that she's presenting right now. I don't know what you would present, but maybe not super meek, super matronly, super whatever. I don't know, maybe a little more authentic, a little more, I don't know. What's your take on how she's reading to the jury?
You know, Tony, juries hate to be tricked. They're not asking to be there. They're taking time off work for multiple weeks on end in a case like this. And if they think someone's pulling the wool over their eyes, that can influence how they're viewing this case. So I think that, the advice to the client, like you said, is to be real about it. You don't want a presentation that is, a stark contrast from everything else they've done. You want a whole person who might be experiencing a spectrum of emotions and certainly a ton of different varying life experiences. But if that presentation for the client in trial is so markedly different from, you know, the presentation on the body cam, the presentation when she was trying to market her book, things like that, the jury is going to start to say, wait a sec, is this person trying to trick me? And especially on the criminal defense side, that can be the death knell.
Yeah. How do you think her reactions are playing right now? Because we've been getting some Corey reactions to different things, and it's always very much a, are you serious sort of look when someone's testifying? And it could be taken, I mean, the way I'm looking at it personally, and the way I'm taking it is like, are you serious? You're saying this? This can't possibly be true. I can't believe you're lying on the stand about this. That's the words that come to my mind when I see her reactions. And I'm sure that's probably the words that she's trying to implant in the jurors' minds as well with her reactions. And I don't know. I mean, it's reading somewhat authentic to me. But again, we see this track record of her manipulating people left and right. The jurors are going to have to take that into account and go, is she trying to do the same to us?
Totally. And Mark Fry, 4304, brings up a good point in the comments where he says, you know, wasn't there already a complaint about her making faces to the jury? So judges are on top of this. They're watching the defendant because it's improper to communicate some kind of response or message to the jury through your reaction sitting at the defense table. And I've been in trials where the judge has admonished my side saying, hey, look, you're rolling your eyes and you're, having these reactions that are improper because they're essentially giving your response to the testimony without you having to testify. And the jury is not supposed to be subject to that. Mm-hmm. So I think the judge is going to keep a close eye on it. I think her reactions have been pretty reasonable, a little over the top at times. But I'm sure that the judge is keeping a close eye on that because that can get out of hand.
You know, it's interesting on that point, Tony. I've been doing the best I can to watch her in the trial and also the 911 call, the things that we look at behaviorally, because a lot of people love to jump on the behavior stuff and come to conclusions one way or the other. But believe it or not, in my opinion, she's been okay, you know, as well. I mean, I haven't seen anything really. She's not a Donald Adelson. I mean, that was an easy one. You know, she's not demonstratively over the top, incongruent with what you would expect someone in these situations. And even in the courtroom, you know, to Eric's point, you know, she's being admonished for, you know, doing reactions to the jury. But they're not like incongruent with what a normal person that would typically react like, I think, in those situations. So again, I think a behavior is not something they can really rest on of guilty or not guilty, is that the jury's looking at anyway.
Not proper, you said, Eric, not proper to do that. I get it, not proper. But at the end of the day, people are going to make the reactions that they're going to do. I mean, I'm not saying that the judge is, because I don't think she's going too far down that road, but she is having human reactions that are congruent with her story, that are congruent with the defense's side of things.
That's a good point.
If you're being accused of this and someone's on the stand making accusations against you, and she's looking like she's insulted, like she's shocked, like, where are you coming from with this? Her reactions line up with all of that, which, okay, if she's innocent, that does make sense. If she's trying to spin a tale, then, well, that makes sense, too. She's trying to get that out there. But beyond just being not proper, what sort of latitude does a judge have to quash any of that, other than saying, jury, don't take her reactions into consideration? Do they ever remove the client from the courtroom or the defendant out of the courtroom if they just can't keep their reactions to themselves?
So I was in a homicide trial last year where the judge claimed that issue kept coming up. And the judge at first said, hey, do I have to make you face away from the jury during this trial? Like move your seat such that the jury can no longer see you? Yeah, right. And then ultimately, if there is such a decorum violation and the judge gives multiple warnings and the person keeps doing it, that's potentially contempt. And if it's contempt, the judge can remove the defendant from the trial and have them view it remotely. That's an extreme measure for sure. But mm-hmm. I've seen judges threaten it multiple times.
That reaction can have that big of an impact on the jury. And I mean, I think it can. I don't think we're close to that here, but I don't know. It feels like as the water continues to fill the Titanic, from steerage to first class, that the desperation or the reactions that we're getting out of Corey seem to be amping up. So who knows what's going to happen once we get to the defense end of things here. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube and Substack. We'd love for you to participate in the conversation. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts. You don't miss any of our conversations on this case. Before the jury ever decides whether Corey Richens murdered her husband, they've already learned a lot about who she is. Her phone showed searches for fentanyl poisoning, how to delete iPhone messages moments after first responders left the house where Eric lay dead. Her phone was used to access deleted memes. One caption, I'm really rich. She allegedly wrote a letter from jail coaching her family on what to say, the walk the dog letter. That's been introduced now, too. A handwriting expert says Eric probably didn't sign his own life insurance policies. 3 days after his death, she was texting about more drugs. Eric Faddis is with us to help us break this all down. Eric, when the defendant has a documented pattern of deception, which they have laid out pretty well here, lying to friends, allegedly coaching witnesses from jail. I mean, she stole roughly $45,000 from a friend for a real estate investment. It was supposed to go over here. It went to Corey's debts, and her friend was just out of luck with that. It paints a really damning picture of someone who really doesn't have a lot of care for other people other than themselves. It doesn't necessarily make someone a murderer, but it really shows what is at the core of their character. How is all of this at the end of the day going to play out in a jury's mind? Is it direct evidence of guilt, or does it mainly hurt her if she actually takes the stand, knowing what her past track record has been with others in this planet?
You know, Tony, there's this legal fixture that judges impose in trials whereby they presume that the jury is going to follow all the jury instructions. Those instructions in part state that, hey, you've got to base your decision on the evidence, not on how you feel about somebody, whether you like somebody or not. But that's not real. That's a fiction. That's not how human beings operate. Mm-hmm. And so, the jury is going to look at that. And some folks are going to say, gosh, if her character is so shitty and deceptive and manipulative, does that mean she has the capacity to pull this off? Does that mean that she's the type of person who could actually poison their husband and try to get away with it? And I think that's a real problem for the defense. And it's hard to neutralize that, but that is going to be playing in those jurors' minds, whether that's legally appropriate or not.
You know, we don't know what the defense is going to do, and, you know, at least we don't know what the witnesses are going to pull. What would be the ideal witness you think they could pull from her, Corey's life, and what could they potentially say that could offset or at least, you know, put a wedge in that thought process of her just being this horrendous, manipulative person that's taken advantage of all these people?
You know,
conjecture, hypothetical one.
One thing they could consider, Robin. So, Corey Richmond's credibility has been attacked. The fact, you know, it's been shown by the prosecution allegedly she's deceptive, manipulative, that kind of thing. So I think the defense would be entitled to put on some character witnesses as to her character for honesty. And so, you know, they could garner people throughout her life, personally, professionally, family members, co-workers, friends, neighbors, things like that, where Corey Richens was a stand-up person and where she was true to her word and where she was consistent in her statements and her behavior. And so I think that they could do some damage control in that aspect, but that assumes you can find such witnesses and they could testify to that truthfully. And that can be a bigger ask than perhaps one might perceive.
Yeah. Have you seen cases where you've had such a preponderance of negative things towards a client and they were actually able to counter for the jury through character witnesses and overcome that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, for example, a homicide case that I did not too long ago, they were saying that my client was violent. And so we put on a bunch of witnesses as to his reputation for peacefulness. And we were able to sort of overcome these harsh allegations by saying, no, you know, look at the people closest to this person. They know this individual's character. They're giving you examples in real life from years ago that occurred before any of this alleged court case was going on. So it wasn't like to try to improve their position or anything in the court case. And so, yeah, there are ways to neutralize it, but it takes a lot of planning, a lot of investigation.
It'll be interesting because even like Lori De Belvallo, they were completely unable to bring these types of people to court because she was just, and I know one of our listeners has to take a drink now, a nutter.
Nothing like getting drunk before noon, you know?
Because I take a shot every time I say nutter.
And some judges are cautious about letting in that type of character witness. In fact, I've had trials where I've been limited in the number of such witnesses I could put on.
That's interesting.
So it's kind of a delicate dance. You got to pick your best heavy hitters and try to show the jury the whole person whom they're evaluating.
How damning is the walk the dog letter? They just introduced it. They've seen it now. The jury has gone through it. The explanation that the defense is giving it is, you know, it was a manuscript to a larger 68-page novel. 68-page novel. About it was character development, even though it's like clearly a letter to her mom saying, hey, tell this person to say this, tell this person to do. I mean, I don't really know how you, other than just speaking the words aloud, saying it's a novel, it translates into that. I mean, you might as well say it's a watercolor drawing. Like, no, it's clearly it's words on a sheet, six sheets, actually, that say that. But it's a watercolor. No, it's not a watercolor, just like it's not a novel. I don't think the jury's going to buy that it was part of a novel. What else can they do to explain this thing away? And will they be able to?
I think as defense, you've got to kind of own some of your weaknesses. And you might get up there in closing and say something like, they've proven that Corey Richens has terrible judgment. She has terrible judgment. She's sort of unwieldy. She's not thinking these things through. She's an artist and an author, and she's eccentric, and she's making all these weird calls. But she's not on trial for making weird calls. She's not on trial for having bad judgment, and she's not on trial for being bad with money. That's arguable. But I think you kind of go down that route that, hey, this is some sort of, you know, flustered, eccentric person going through some crazy life. safe stuff, and that's not the same as witness tampering or something along those lines. That's one way to play it.
it's funny, Tony, as you're saying that, it's like character development. The only image that popped in my mind is that, you know, the next scheme that she's going to try to do is personal development coach or Corey
Richards.
Yeah,
she'll be a life coach.
Coach Corey Richards.
While selling Amway. I mean, I'm waiting for like the defense to get up there. And by the way, have you heard about this product that can change your life? Corey's going to like show up in a pink Cadillac. She'll be selling Mary Kay.
Like Mark's defense there, my client's an idiot.
it's gone up there like, look, she's, I don't know what the hell she was doing. All valid arguments, Eric. She could do this, they could do that, but I just don't see any of them landing. I don't think you have a way to land that thing. It was never intended to be seen to begin with, and obviously it has been. It's not part of a book. It's damning. It's very damning. But we'll see how that plays with the jury. Another damning thing is her search history. Fentanyl poisoning before they even really knew much about being fentanyl. How to delete iPhone messages. Death benefit insurance payouts. Some of it can be explained away. Because if your partner died and, you know, you want to get the insurance money you are entitled to, yeah, you're going to look those sort of things up. If you're not familiar with how that works, though, some can be argued as legitimate. But how damning do you think her search history is as compared to some of the other cases that we've seen with, very, very damning search histories, like about dismembering bodies and things of that nature?
You know, it's of course problematic. And if I'm the prosecutor in that, I'm saying, you know, hey, look, let's look at this one search. Okay, this can be interpreted multiple ways, seems suspect, but it's one search. Well, let's look at another search. Well, let's look at a third search. Let's look at a fourth search. And now let's turn to forging documents on forging financial documents to try to benefit from the death of your husband. Now let's look towards witness tampering. Now let's look towards, you know, you build and build and build and say, hey, even if we take these things in isolation, and there might be multiple reasonable interpretations. When you look at the totality of these things all together, it reeks of guilt. And I think that's how the prosecution's going to style it.
Out of all those things, there's such a preponderance of communication that is not benefiting her whatsoever. You know, what are some ideas that you would have as defense or that you'd be advising them on now? Like, what would you do to kind of counter some of those things?
Yeah, you know, I don't think it would be prudent to put Corey on the stand. That's one way. So you call your client and you have him explain it, but she would be just, crucified up there. So I don't think that's
what, okay. So let's go down that first then, Eric. So what would be, because I know that's on everyone's mind, will she take a stand or not take a stand? What do you think would be her greatest liability up there on the stand?
I think the search history, and she's got, and you know, they would go in a painstaking way through each and every search. Let's highlight this fentanyl term. Let's highlight life insurance payouts. Let's highlight, and you tell this jury how this does not relate to your husband dying of a fentanyl overdose and you getting paid insurance. Like, and so it's really like you have this trained prosecutor, and then you have this just regular person on the stand who's not used to this scenario. Just being in the courtroom is nerve-wracking, and sometimes it's hard to articulate well in there. And I think you would just let her hang herself on trying to explain away the search history, and then also the requests allegedly of the housekeeper for the drugs, and you just keep, you know, let her hang herself with tripping over her own feet, putting her foot in her mouth and screwing herself over.
Do you think she's going to take the stand? I mean, at the end of the day, Corey has a track record of thinking she's smarter than everyone else. And obviously, it's her choice at the end of the day if she wants to take this in. Her attorneys, I'm sure, are probably saying, bad idea. Don't do this. Don't do this. But at the end of the day, she's the one who seems to swoop in and think she has a solution, like, you know, taking out payday loans to cover bad debts, writing a check to your housekeeper for drugs. That's another fun part of all this that we're learning is that for the drugs, she wrote a check. She wrote and made it out for cleaning, like for an exorbitant amount, which cleaning. Like clearly if you're going to be buying your drugs and you may have killed somebody with said drugs, I don't know, a check might not be the best route of payment. I mean, just trace it back to me. Here's a way to do it. I mean, she could have denied she ever paid it had she not written a check. But it, again, just Corey seems to think she has the better ideas than everyone in the room. Is there a world where Corey's going to take the stand here? And is there a way where she can navigate this? She has been able to bamboozle a lot of people in her life. Now, these weren't the brightest folks. We can give them that. Look at the housekeeper. Look at all the folks that have taken the stand that she has bamboozled. The boyfriend seems like a lovely guy. Probably not the sharpest crayon in the box, though, either. So she's selective at who she's able to bamboozle, because I think it requires a certain IQ level to be bamboozled by Corey Richens. But I don't think Corey realizes what that number is in terms of IQ. I think she just thinks the world takes whatever she says and eats it out of her hand. What do you think? Is there a world where she can take the stand here and turn this jury around into her favor?
You know, in the comments, Gen Z thinks she will. And I think there's a reasonable possibility of that. She seems like the type of unwieldy client who is prone to impulsive conduct and is also detached from reality, doesn't realize how her conduct is going to be perceived by other people.
Yeah.
And so I could see her attorneys are like, whoa, 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 you don't need to do this. And I don't think she needs to do it to win. And she might say, you know what, I'm going to tell my story. This is my right. We saw an audacious move by her in sending that letter to her mother. Every jail inmate knows that your correspondence is in and out of jail are going to be monitored. Someone's going to look at this. She did it anyway. Way, sort of in a detached way, probably not foreseeing the damning interpretation that people are going to have from that. Could that same feeling motivate her to take the stand? Very well could.
You know, Eric, you said an interesting statement in there, and that was, you don't think she needs to do that to win. What do you think she needs to do to win?
Yeah, you know, it's not like a self-defense case where oftentimes, you know, the question is whether there was a reasonable fear of imminent bodily harm. Sometimes the defendant has to get up there and say, hey, I was scared for these reasons. That's not the defense here. The defense here is essentially that I think that Eric Richens either accidentally overdosed or committed suicide or something like that. And so I think what they need to do is continue to show any evidence that they have of Eric Richens' drug use, his proximity to drugs, that kind of thing. And I'm not saying such evidence exists, but if it does, I think that that's sort of the seed they have to plant in the minds of the jury. And you can do that without Corey taking the stand.
And Tony, I'm just going to add a little bit to what you're saying about the poor mopes in her life. I think there's a lot of good people. She just had a very, very powerful skill set over them. And what happens with every human being is when you have someone that is so toxic like her, like Corey, they're very, very adept at finding your trigger, finding your lever. And I think that, you know.
No. Robin, I did think we lost Robin for a moment there. I mean, it's very interesting to look at the folks that Corey bamboozled, because a lot of folks like, oh, this couldn't happen to me. There's no way that this could happen to me. I couldn't be bamboozled by somebody like this. But people are bamboozled by folks like this every day, especially someone like Corey Richens. Because, I mean, just look at the woman. This is not the person that you think is capable of this list of things that she's accused of. I mean, it's pretty damning. It's pretty bad. And it's easy to put your best foot forward and think that this person could not possibly be capable of doing something like this. Is there anything that she can do at the end of the day here, kind of to what Robin's question was, to try and sway this jury? Reasonable doubt is all they have to get to. How do they get to reasonable doubt here if she doesn't take the stand?
I think they need to engage in some character rehabilitation if they can, if they have the witnesses to do that, to sort of even the scales, to say, hey, look, you heard one side of things. Now you're going to hear the whole story. And so that's one approach. In addition to that, they don't have a legal burden to do this, but they have a practical burden to put forth some reasonable alternative explanation that is not just speculation, that isn't just, you know, he could have died from an overdose. Well, what evidence there to support that? Yeah. And you know, I'll be interested to see what they put forth in terms of prior substance use, if that happened and if the judge allows it. And then also just sort of really muddying up the waters in terms of the substance itself and what actually killed this guy. If you're going to condemn this woman with a scarlet letter for a murder conviction, you better be damn well sure how they died and from where they got it. And the prosecution can't tell you that.
And the investigation was crap. I mean, the thing is, we're in a world here where two things can certainly be true. She can be a murderer and you can have a really horrible investigation. It happens all the time. But certainly the defense is going to lean heavily on all of the hiccups and all the missteps in this investigation. Is that going to be enough at the end of the day to sway a jury?
You know, in addition to arguing that, hey, there's this confusion around the type of substance that caused the death and from where it was procured and by whom, on top of that, you have the government, who has unlimited resources, putting their finger on the scales of justice by intimidating their own witnesses and ensuring that their witnesses get up there and say what this government wants them to say to condemn Corey Richens and also just let off these other admitted criminals, either scot-free or with substantial immunity. And you know, is this fair? Is this how you think a homicide trial should go? Is this something that you can place enough faith in to condemn a person for the rest of their life? I think they got to hit all angles, and the shitty investigation is a part of it.
Robin, I'll give you the last word here. You were making a point. Why didn't you?
I know. I'm so sorry. Yeah. We lost internet at our house. It just blipped on us. We're in the middle of a snowstorm in July, it feels like. So what was I saying, Tony?
you were talking about the character, I think.
So, you know, it's important to remember, I think, when we're talking about Corey, to realize that people like her that are so adept at manipulation, have lifetime of reps, that, you know, there's a lot of victims in this. And victims aren't necessarily people that are weak of character, weak of mind, or easily duped. It's just that people like Corey are such toxic manipulators that they can find these levers of influence over you and wield them very, very effectively. So I want to make sure that, you know, we're not shaming anyone for falling into her trap.
No.
Because she's just got a lot of crazy going on.
Yeah. She's one of those folks. And you look back and go, how? Well, they're out there. Yeah, they are out there. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always, thank you so much for your insight on this case. Robin Drake, as always, thank you for your insight on this case. Your thoughts in the comment section, we'd love to see them. Substack and YouTube, the two places you can do just that. We'll continue our conversation there. And be sure to press subscribe wherever you are getting podcasts, whether it be Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever. Hit subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage and this and the many cases we got for you right here. All right, we'll continue the conversation in the comments. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21+. Terms and conditions apply.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At ChumbaCasino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.